I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ, and archived on TVTimeMachine.com.
13?
86.
Anything to report?
Top secret. New bright white pepsinant with zirconium silicate gets teeth bright white.
Gotcha. New pepsinant with zirconium coliate gets...
Zirconium chromate.
Zirconium coliate.
Zirconium.
Zirconium
coliate.
New pepsinant with zirconium silicate gets teeth bright white.
Gotcha.
New bright white Pepsodent, now with a special polishing agent, zirconium silicate, to get even hard to whiten teeth their whitest.
Here we are back with the extravagant Gentile and Wonder Jew.
We're back again with TV and movie legend Mel Brooks right here on the TV Time Machine.
Zirconium silicate. Wow. Who knew?
Who knew? Yeah, well, that's what's kept my teeth from falling out all these years.
Wow.
Mel, in 1961, you met your future wife, actress Anne Bancroft.
Yeah.
Tell us how you two met and what kind of gal she was.
Well, you know, you're venturing into dangerous territory. Mm. I'm still in the throes of missing her very, very, very much.
Yeah. Well, she was a great actress. She really was.
Yeah, I think she was the best. I was with Charles Strauss, who just wrote a book, by the way, you know, called Put on a Happy Face.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Strauss wrote Annie. He wrote Bye Bye Birdie. He did the music, and Lee Adams did the lyrics, and sometimes other people did lyrics, but mostly Lee Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Strauss was working with Anne Bancroft at the Actor Studio. He was a piano player, and she was doing Henry Higgins, and he had to talk to her. She was at a rehearsal at a Perry Como show, and he had to talk to her about a key. And so he said, come on over. I just have to talk to Anne Bancroft. I said, Anne Bancroft, oh, my God, I'm one in the miracle work.
Right.
So I said, okay. I went over. As I entered the Ziegfeld Theater on 54th Street and 6th Avenue, Avenue of the Americas, if you will, she was singing Married I Can Always Get, a Gertrude Nielsen hit song. She was wearing a white, kind of a white beaded silk clinging dress. And she was singing beautifully on this Perry Como show. It was a rehearsal. And when it ended, I broke into cheers and screamed. I said, I love you. And she said, who the hell are you? And I said, I'm Mel Brooks. And she said, that was 5:30 in the afternoon, and February 5, 1961. It was a cold afternoon. I waited for her to leave, and I said, can I get you a cab? She said, sure. I said, where are you going? She said, the William Morris. I said, oh, my God, the William Morris. I have to be there. So, you know, we had to be there at 6 o'clock at night. So anyway, I got the guy whistled. She loved my whistle. That was the first time she really liked me, my whistle.
There you go.
And then we got a cab. We went over to the William Morris office. She said, have you seen The Miracle Worker? I said, no. She did the whole play for me. And she obviously liked me. I liked her. And, you know, we knew we had something because she was so beautiful. And I found out that week from Herb Gardner, who wrote 1,000 Clowns, and Jerry Orbach, who was another friend of hers, and Martha Cura, who was Jerry's wife, was very close to Anne, and so she knew where Anne would be all the time, and she'd tell me, and I would show up, and I'd say, Kismet! You're here, I'm here, you know, every night. She said, stop it, Kismet, you know. And then she said, all right, come on, let's hang out, so she became my, I said, you're going to be my foreign movie pal, you know.
That's great.
I love foreign movies. And she knew my record. I had just made the record in 60, somewhere, and Steve Allen forced Carl and I to make this record. We were doing it at parties, and God bless him, he made us make the record. So we made this 2,000-year-old man, and Ann heard it, loved it. So we became, you know, and we never stopped adoring each other, you know, and I only had one child, and that was Max, and Ann and I had a very, very special, a very unique, and very, you know, blessed, very blessed relationship, and, you know, we needed each other, we We hung on to, we clung to each other. We supported each other. We entertained each other. We were actually very good personal friends.
Right. Well, that's the most important thing. That really is the most important thing. I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of marriages don't last or are not successful. The two people are not friends first.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the trouble with a lot of marriages is that the wives have their best girlfriends that they have coffee clutches and talk to and reveal everything. And the guys, you know, still have the old, I don't know, that high school sensibility where they want to hang out and drink beer and watch ball games.
Yeah.
That's okay if it's within reason. But when you really have to spill your guts and empty your heart, it should be to only one person. It should be to your wife or your husband.
I agree. And I was lucky because I got married at the age of 43 for the first time.
Wow.
My wife, same age, first time for her too.
Wow.
And so, fortunately, we don't have that bachelor and bachelorette mentality anymore. We grew out of it.
Aren't you lucky you finished with that?
Yes. That's right.
So ask away. Jim, ask away.
Well, we were talking about your son, Max. You also kind of created another little boy named Danny Baker in 1963.
How did you remember that?
You wrote a TV pilot about an industrious young boy. In this clip, he meets Yankees pitcher Whitey Ford.
Yes, Mr. Ford. Excuse me for not getting up, but I happen to be dying.
Oh, sure. That's okay. I was just on my way to the ballpark when I saw your painting. And I had to just stop by and tell you you're about the best artist in the whole world.
Gee, Mr. Ford, coming from you, that sure means a lot.
If it wouldn't be too much trouble, would you mind autographing my baseball?
By the way, Mel, I love this show. Tell us about the genesis of Inside Danny Baker.
I don't know. I was, give me a date. Do you have a date on that?
Yeah, it was 1963. It was a pilot that you wrote for ABC. It was based on cartoonist William Stieg's Dreams of Glory.
Yes.
Which was a series of cartoons of pint-sized heroes who saved the day and saved the world.
Yes, I'm trying to think of a movie that Danny Kaye did. Walter Mitty, I think, was
the name of it. That's right. That's right.
And I think that, for me, that was the inspiration, and in addition to Stieg, you know? I said, this could be done. It's kind of a little kid Walter Mitty.
Exactly.
You know, the Dreams of Glory, and I said, we all have dreams of glory, you know? Every kid wants to get kryptonite or something, you know? You know, every kid wants to be Batman. So, it resonated, and I wrote it. I don't know what happened. It just, I guess it didn't appeal at the time. You know, there's a lot of luck in show business. As much as talent, there's luck. If the right executive, the right suit, comes to the right show at the right time and falls in love with the concept, and then you got a shot, you know? And if there's not the right guy there, or if there's another show similar to it that's already on the air, I mean, so much has to do with chance and with luck. It's an amazing thing. And I've been very lucky that the things I've done stuck their heads up and were noticed.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Inside Danny Baker, to me, it was sort of a more sophisticated version of Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah, it was, exactly.
Yeah, a cerebral version of Leave It to Beaver. And what was really unique was you shot it on location in New York City.
Yeah.
For a situation comedy at that time, very unusual.
I don't know. Where did I get the clout for that? Because I hadn't done The Producers yet. I hadn't made, and I hadn't done Get Smart.
Yeah, yeah.
I had nothing behind me, but the Show of Shows, which was by then passé. And I had no other credits. You know, except a 2,000-year-old man, it'd be pretty sophisticated to like that.
Do you remember, was it your idea to use Whitey Ford?
No, this was somebody else's idea. I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, well, I didn't think it was your idea because you grew up in Brooklyn.
I grew up in Brooklyn.
He's a Yankee.
I would have used Mel Ott. Because he had the name Mel, and because I was a Giants fan.
That's right, that's right. Mel, in 1965, you introduced to the nation a fearless foe fighting the forces of fear and fascism in the form of a slapsticky secret agent named Smart.
Smart here. Maxwell Smart. Mission accomplished. Professor Dante rescued. Chaos destroyed. And I take great pride in saying that the forces of evil have once again been foiled in their attempt to extinguish the torch of liberty. That? Oh, sorry. Wrong number.
Mel, how did you get together with Buck Henry to create Get Smart?
He was suggested by Danny Melnick of Talent Associates. It was David Susskind and Danny Melnick owned and ran Talent Associates, which was a production company in New York. And I think Danny suggested, why don't you meet with Buck Henry and when you're writing this? And I did, and I loved him immediately. And I said, this is a smart and very bright, very crazy, very personable guy. So he liked to shoot pool, and there was a pool table up at Talent Associates, with the production offices. So we shot pool and rode every night, and we finally got it done.
Well, one of the funniest and most memorable aspects of Get Smart can be heard in the following clip.
You're very clever, my charming little friend, but not clever enough. You see, the moment I suspected there was something wrong with this old scow, I immediately telephoned headquarters. And I happen to know that at this very minute, 7 Coast Guard cutters are converging on this boat. Would you believe it? 7.
I find that pretty hard to believe.
Would you believe 6?
I don't think so.
How about 2 cops and a rowboat?
Mel, did you have any idea that the elements in your pilot with Buck Henry, such as the phrase, would you believe, and the cone of silence, would become comic staples and continue for the next 5 years?
No idea. No idea that the shoe telephone would work so well, and now it's called a cell phone.
That's right.
Yeah, I think we invented it.
So
I didn't invent it. It was Chester Gould created a character called Dick Tracy, mm-hmm. and on his wrist he had a wristwatch telephone, so I was not the first.
Now, at the time, were there any thoughts of casting anyone other than Don Adams and Barbara Feldon in the roles of Max and 99?
Yeah, I think there was. I think Tom Poston did the original one, and it didn't get sold.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know if we filmed the Tom Poston one, or I think we did. I'm not sure. It's hazy, but I know that. And it was for a different network or a different production company. I think it was still Talent Associates, but we couldn't get that one off the ground. And maybe it wasn't Mr. Big. Maybe it wasn't such a good script.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Buck Henry and I came up with Mr. Big, we knew that would work. And we had seen this comic around town, and it was Don Adams was so good and so talented, and he basically did William Powell.
That's right.
That was his impression. Inspector? You know, that was, Inspector, let me say this. You know, and he was just, he was fabulous. So, you know, he was a perfect, you know. By the way, this guy, you know, Steve Carell.
Right.
Is perfect.
Yes.
He's not doing Inspector. He's not doing anything like that. He's just doing himself.
That's right.
But he plays Spielkes Nudnik or somebody. I don't know. He plays somebody. But he is. He isn't. He's just very good. Here's a very, very precisely talented hip guy who knows. He knows how to do it. You know. And I'm glad he never was refreshing that he didn't do
an impression.
An impression right. of Don Adams. Yeah.
It was tough, though, I think, for Don, because that characterization was so indelibly etched in the public's consciousness that I think it was difficult for him to get roles after that because he was so typed.
Yeah. He never got another role after that that made any sense.
Yeah. How did Get Smart change your life, both personally and professionally?
Well, I was going with Ann Bancroft from 1960, I told you, February 5th, 1961, until August 1964, when Get Smart was picked up. When it was picked up, and I knew that I didn't have to live on Ann Bancroft's salary, that I could make a living.
Right.
Because I hadn't worked since the Show of Shows. I mean, well, there was some money. I was selling matches and shoelaces. I wasn't doing too badly, you know. But we had a contract for 13 or something, you know. We picked up the 13 in those days. And I knew I'd get 13 paychecks, so I married Ann.
There you go.
And that was August 5th, 1964.
Now, did you want to be more involved in the day-to-day production of Get Smart?
Well, I was for the first season, mm-hmm. and then I had, you know, I had other things I wanted to do, you mm-hmm. know. I thought, you know, this is a great show, but, you know, we had amazing people like Leonard Stern who understood the show, who could work with Barbara Felton and Ed Platt and Don Adams so easily and skillfully and control the writing, and you know, so Lenny Stern really was, it was like, you know, when you bring in a big ship from overseas, you need a brilliant pilot.
Yes.
A pilot boat.
Yes.
To moor it, to land, you know, to bring it in and moor it safely, and mm-hmm. and he was our pilot.
Right, because he could write, produce, and direct.
And direct. He could do everything. I got Howie Morris the job of directing Mr. Big. Howard Morris was Uncle Goopy in This Is Your Life. And he was the third banana on your show of shows, and Sid Caesar's show. And he became a director. And I think he directed with six, you get egg roll.
That's right.
You know, and he had a wonderful career. And he was a very good, sharp little director. And I knew that Mr. Big would be in good hands with Howie Morris.
Well, Mel, during the decade of the 60s, you appeared on quite a few TV game shows, not the least of which was a show called The Celebrity Game, hosted by your old friend, Carl Reiner.
Do movie stars really enjoy playing love scenes?
I said yes because I don't care whether it's yes or no, because it's another dopey question. I have to answer.
You found out this is not Meet the Press. Huh?
Right. Actually, I hope no, because my wife does that a lot.
Oh.
She has scenes in movies
right.
with men of the opposite race.
Wait a minute. Sex.
Men of the opposite gender? Religion.
You're allowed to say sex on right. television.
Men of the opposite sex.
Right.
Can I say sex twice? Yeah. Sex.
Right.
Mel, what has Carl Reiner meant to you, both as a friend and as a fellow professional?
Well, he's still my best friend.
Yes.
And he's always been a love force and a creative force in my life, and he's been, you know, he's an analyst. You don't have to pay. You know, it's
that's
a pleasure.
Good.
You know, you could call Carl and say, "Carl, I have an anxiety attack," and he says, "Well, what's it about?" You sit down, and it's gone. You know, he's doing. But anyway, you know, or you say, "You need some sesame candy." I'm passing Gelson's. So, you know, whatever. He's there. He's a rock. He's the rock. He's the call is there for me, and if he needs me, I'm there for him.
Well, you mentioned the 2,000-year-old man before. What was the exact genesis of that with Carl?
The genesis is hard. I don't understand the word genesis. You said, what was the exact beginning?
Oops.
Genesis sounds like a chapter from the Bible. I don't know. We were in the writers' room together. Carl came in and said, "Writers' room of the show of shows." Carl came in and said, "This is a wire recorder, not a tape. This is a wire recorder. You speak into it, and it talks back to you." He came in one night with this tape recorder and said, "Sir, I understand that it's been said that you are actually 2,000 years old." He came up with it, and I said, "Well, not exactly, you know." And I went in, you know, and I faked a Jewish accent, and I did a little this, and then that's how it started. And so one time we were doing this thing out in Beverly Hills at Carl's house, and a lot of people were there. George Burns and, you know, and Edward G. Robinson. I mean,
wow.
You know, and some people from Broadway. And Steve Allen was there, and we did about an hour. We wanted to do 10 minutes, but we ended up doing an hour. Everybody was hysterical with the character, and Steve... First of all, Edward G. Robinson came up to me and said, "Have you done anything with this? If you don't, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be that guy."
Really?
So Steve Allen said, "No, they're going to make a recording." I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, World Pacific Records." Steve Allen said, "Look, you can burn it, you can tear it if you don't like it. And do it. Let's see what happens."
Right.
So we did it. It was a kind of a hit record for World Pacific. They sold it to Capitol for a lot of money. We got a little of that, and then we had a recording contract with Capitol. And we ended up doing, I think we ended up doing three.
And I think that one of the reasons it's so successful and people remember it after all these years, the 2,000-year-old man routine, is because of the improv nature and the relationship that you have with Carl. It's not just the bit.
No, because it's my bounden duty to hit, for him to hit the floor
right.
out of control, holding his belly.
There you go.
And yelping and uncontrolled laughter. You know, that's my job.
Well, Mel, we're going to have to take a little break for a brief musical interlude.
What? But I'm just starting.
But we'll be back in a moment with Mel Brooks, who is riding along with us on the TV Time Machine.
Right.